From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Hi there, it's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. News, information, miracles, coming to you from Midtown Manhattan. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart.
Allison, I don't know how to turn my headphones up, but I'm just going to trust you that we're
you
on the
air. You keep doing that. That's my headphone knob.
Sorry about that.
Buddy, you do this every show. You
right.
turn off. I can't hear you. I can't hear me. I can't hear anything. Why don't you just tell them what's on the show
the
and keep
knob.
Your hands off my knob.
All right. Fine. While we're fixing that, we've got lots coming up on the show today. An NBA, former NBA ref, Tim Donaghy, pled guilty to gambling on NBA games. People are wondering if Mike Vick is going to be the next big sports figure to fall.
And we've been talking about recalls from Mattel. 19 million toys internationally, over half of them from China. We're going to get to the details with our buddy NPR's own Adam Davidson. He'll be in the studio.
Adam Davidson has appeared on almost every edition of the Bryant Park Project.
Because he's the smartest guy we
know. He's the Cal Ribkin of financial... whatever he does. We're going to talk to the Danish dance pop band Junior Senior. Now, I know you hear Danish dance pop and your toes don't start wiggling, but it's good music. You're going to want to stick around for that.
All right, I'm ready for you to sell me on that one. Also, think about this. Are we living in a matrix? You know when weird things happen, you wonder why they happen? It could possibly be because we're all just players in somebody's video game. The BBP will break your brain a little bit later in the show.
First, though, let's get to today's top story.
The quake was very strong and very very long. People were very very scared. They were crying and they were praying because they fear a disaster.
At least 337 people are confirmed dead so far. Hundreds more injured in Peru, where a magnitude 7.9 earthquake struck last night. The quake was actually centered in the Pacific Ocean near the country's Ica region, that's south of the capital, Lima.
Now, according to the AP, some 200 people were crushed under the rubble of a collapsed church in the town of Pisco. Eyewitnesses said most of that town leveled by this quake.
Yeah. Interestingly, Peru's doctors had just called a national strike, but they quickly ended that as soon as the earthquake hit. And the president of Peru went on TV and called on all doctors to volunteer their services for free to people who were injured.
There's actually a woman quoted in the New York Times said she counted 70 aftershocks. Obviously, tsunami warnings were issued, but the wave turned out to be not that big a deal, just about 1 foot high.
And Peru is on what's sort of known as the Ring of Fire. It's this giant seam of pressure that runs from South America all the way up the west coast of the U.S. and then kind of horseshoes around and goes back down to Japan. And it just seemed like in our meeting this morning that there's been a lot of activity along this kind of ring of fire, as it's called. And we wanted to find out if there's something going on, if people on the west coast, particularly in the U.S., should be worried. So we tracked down Bill Leith. He's with the Earthquake Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
Could you kind of put this in perspective for us, what happened in Peru last night? What would this magnitude earthquake do if it happened in, you know, a major U.S. city?
Oh, it would have a very serious consequence in a U.S. city. We're particularly concerned about large earthquakes, maybe not even this large, occurring in a major populated area like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, where they would have very, very great consequences.
There was in Indonesia last week, there was a volcano that sort of went off. And it just seems, again, maybe this is anecdotal, does there a lot of stuff going on along this seam, or are we just imagining that?
Well, earthquakes occur around the Ring of Fire, around this set of boundaries between the big plates of the Earth's crust. They occur regularly. We've got in around the world a magnitude 6 earthquake occurring on average about every 2.5 days. So it's not unusual to have this earthquake in Peru. There have been a couple of earthquakes of similar size in the last 100 years. And an even larger earthquake in the 19th century in the same area in Peru.
Is there any way to know if there's a big one on the way or we're building up to something?
If that's what has been called prediction. You know, we do know which areas of this country and the world are most prone to earthquakes. We know about statistically about what frequency they occur at, how often. Issuing short-term predictions has just proved extremely difficult.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just all walk around hoping that things go okay. Bill Leith with the Earthquake Hazards Program at U.S. Geological Survey. Allison, you wanted to.
I was going to ask you, Luke, have you ever been in an earthquake?
Yeah, I've actually been in a number of them in Seattle and a couple in L.A.
Scary?
Well, the weird thing is that your mind tries to find some rationale for it when it happens. Sure. So everything starts shaking and you think, I remember one time being at work, a big one hit in Seattle, and I thought, oh, there's a huge truck driving by. Another thing happens is you get kind of nauseous because sometimes it's so gentle that your equilibrium senses it, but your body doesn't, and you just feel like kind of car sick.
Just wanted to hear a first-person account.
Yeah. I'm a veteran.
Let's get to some of the other day's top stories with NPR's Matt Martinez.
Good morning, Luke. Good morning, Allison. Good morning, everyone. Some hopeful news from Utah. Rescuers searching for the six trapped coal miners heard the sound of mysterious vibrations in the mountain. The sounds were collected by a microphone and video camera sent into a third hole dug in the mine. Officials are studying the results of air quality samples and may release their findings today. It's been 10 days since the mine collapsed and trapped the men. Tropical storm Erin made landfall this morning near Rockport, Texas, about 25 miles northeast of Corpus Christi. The storm lost speed and was downgraded to a tropical depression. The National Hurricane Center canceled its tropical storm warnings for the Texas Gulf Coast, but five counties remain under flash flood watches through mid-morning. A new report on suicide in the U.S. Army. The Army recorded 17.3 suicides per 100,000 soldiers in 2006. The number of suicides is the highest level since 1991, the time of the Gulf War. Then the Army recorded 102 soldier suicides. Now, so far this year, 44 soldiers have committed suicide, including 17 in either Iraq or Afghanistan. The Army said failed relationships, legal and financial issues, and occupational/operational issues led to the suicides. The Food and Drug Administration will call outside experts to determine if over-the-counter cold medicines are safe for young children to use. The question about the safety of cough syrup came about when health officials in Baltimore noted that some 900 children under the age of five suffered symptoms of an overdose in a one-year period. Now, doctors urged the FDA to require warnings on cold medicine packaging that say it shouldn't be used for children younger than six. Former NBA ref Tim Donaghy pleaded guilty to felony charges for taking cash payoffs from gamblers and betting on games he officiated. Donaghy could be sentenced to 25 years in prison. He was released on a $250,000 bond. More on this story, as well as the plea deal that may be negotiated in the Michael Vick case later on in the show. David Beckham scored on a free kick in the 27th minute of the Los Angeles Galaxy's 2-0 Super League, a semifinal win over the DC United. Beckham's first goal with the Galaxy came in his first start since joining the Major League Soccer team on July 13th. He had played just 37 minutes in two previous games because of a left ankle injury. And word today that Bruce is getting the band back together. Bruce Springsteen's fans are all aflutter that he will reunite with the E Street Band for an album and tour. It would be their first album together since 2002's The Rising. No word on when the official announcement will be made. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org.
Hello, I'm Bob Eckert, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Mattel. As a parent of four children myself, I know that absolutely nothing is more important than the safety and well-being of children. Mattel has recalled some toys for two different reasons. One is impermissible use of lead paint. The other is for risks associated with small, high-powered magnets. I want to ensure that every parent hears about these issues quickly, returns affected products to us, and knows that we've already taken significant actions to further ensure the safety of our toys.
We've all seen our nieces, nephews, sons, and daughters slobber over little painted pieces of plastic people and trucks, painted apparently with cheap lead paint. and made in China. Just this month, there have been two recalls from Mattel. Of course, that's a huge toy company. Now, the lead recall is sort of precautionary. No reports so far of any problems with little ones. Now, the magnets recall, the little magnets used to keep the clothes on the toys, that's another story. At least one child has died, and several others have had serious surgery. Now, aside from the human toll, it's not the news a big old toy company wants to hear 4 months before Christmas. Mattel's not going the no-comment route. In fact, the CEO spoke to NPR's international business and economics correspondent, Adam Davidson, who has strolled on into the studio.
Hey,
Adam. So, were you surprised you were able to get the CEO on the phone and actually sit down and have this lengthy interview with him?
I got to say, I that morning I woke up and you think, oh, I got to call Mattel just because they're not going to respond and I'll just but I'll say they didn't respond to comments. When I got to my desk, there were two messages from Mattel saying, we have a media action plan. NPR is a crucial part of it. When do you want to talk to the CEO? They obviously were making the same phone call to dozens of other news outlets. This was, without question, the most aggressive, proactive crisis management plan I've ever seen. They wanted to get out there and get their message out there. Whether or not that message was fully accurate, that's a different question, but they were very proactive, which you got to give them credit for. Obviously, Christmas is around the corner. That's your big, big time. Do you expect parents to be a little bit cautious of the Mattel name in a way they never were before?
Well, I think parents understand that violations occur or mistakes happen. What's important to them is what we do about it. And I'm here to assure parents that we understand the issues. We understand the problems, we've isolated the problems, and we've taken corrective actions.
So a company like Mattel, the first time when you think of something like this, you wonder, how did this even happen in an enormous company like this? Aren't they supposed to self-police, or isn't there someone who's supposed to police the products they put on the shelves and then we buy and give to our kids?
The general consensus is that the U.S. government, I'm not going to say useless, but close to useless. I mean, it's 1% or so of Chinese import. Toy imports are tested. I'm not sure exactly, but it's around 1%. But so really, our security is in the hands of the companies that do their own testing. Now, Mattel has famously been one of the best. In fact, just like 4 days or something before the first recall, the New York Times had a big profile about how Mattel is the bulletproof, great tester of products and secure supply chain company.
So that reporter is fired, I guess.
that was
the guy who had all the background on WMD, too.
Right.
And actually, what I would say to Mattel's credit is they are the ones finding out about these problems. They are the ones bringing them to our attention. The scary thing is all the companies that aren't testing all their products, aren't letting the federal government know, because the federal government isn't probably going to know any other way. So that's kind of the scarier thing. Not, you know, I almost feel more confident in a way in Mattel toys than in any other company's toys, because now I know Mattel really is testing them.
One of the things I think is the bigger issue, even though this many kind of these toys and kids' health obviously is the headline that catches people's eyes. How much is made in China? I mean, I guess we all kind of intellectually know how much is made in China, but really when you think about 80% of the world's toys come out of China, yet Time Magazine says standards in China are rarely enforced in their manufacturing plants. First of all, why, and is there anything that businesses can do to change that?
Sure. Now, first of all, the scope. 2.4 billion toys come to the U.S. every year from China. That's got to be like, 50 toys per child, something like that. China is many countries. I mean, I've been to China a lot. I've been to a lot of factories, and it's this really confusing place. There are parts of China that are more cutting edge. There are American factory workers and factory owners who go to China and see the next generation. Mm-hmm. China has parts of it that are so advanced, they're more advanced than us, parts of it that are the worst of the developing world, really primitive. It's this chaotic mix that's kind of scary.
Now, doing this story, has it changed the way, you know, sometimes when you're a reporter and you do a story about something, you end up changing your own habits or you think about things a little bit differently. As you do these kind of stories about these recalls of products coming from China, what's changed about the way you live your life?
I have made a commitment in my house,
yes,
with my fiance to not ingest any product from a no-name brand from China or sold in a no-name store.
So the 99-cent store down on 14th Street, I should stay out of it if I want to buy cheap cups.
I don't want to talk about any particular store, but I'm only buying name-brand products from name-brand stores if they're from China. I have a decent degree of confidence in those. I have zero confidence in no-brand products from China.
I do want to bring this right back around to Mattel, because obviously they've been really proactive on the PR front, but practically, what did the CEO tell you that they are going to do to ensure that these toys are safe?
Well, he said the big thing, which surprised me that they weren't doing it already, is they had been testing the raw materials, the inputs to their toy factories. They hadn't been aggressive in testing the final product. And so if somebody messed up somewhere along the way in making the product and added some new foreign material like lead paint, they weren't catching that. So they're going to start testing the final product more aggressively, which makes sense.
All right. Adam Davidson's NPR's international business and economics correspondent. You get that all in one business card?
It's a long business card.
Adam, thanks for walking us through it.
Thank you.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, we are going to go for a ramble. We'll talk about a duct tape bandit. And also, our friend and yours, Tay Zonde. You know him from Chocolate Rain. It's actually he's going to be coming to a town near you.
Wow.
Yeah, may the wonders never cease.
No, that blew my mind more than The Matrix, frankly. Hey, also we get the latest on the Atlanta Falcons' Michael Vick and the NBA ref who pled guilty.
And Hillary Clinton's secret weapon as she runs for president, Huma. Huma? Yeah, that's right, Huma. We'll talk about that coming up on the Bryant Park Project.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart.
How much do we love the Pixies right now? I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to talk to a professor who says there's actually a 20% chance that we are living in a matrix.
It would explain a lot that happens.
A lot about my personal behavior on the show, I can tell you that. He's going to tell us how we would actually know if that was going on. Right now, though, Allison, it's time for a little part of the show we like to call the Ramble.
These are the news stories worth honorable mention. Man robs store? Not so big news. Man robs store with his head wrapped in duct tape? That's news. It happened in Ashland, Kentucky at a liquor store when a 24-year-old apparently decided wrapping his head in duct tape would be a fantastic way to conceal his identity. The store owner also had some duct tape. It was wrapped around a wooden club, which he began to wield. Store employee chased the duct tape bandit out of the store, subdued him until the police arrived, and they promptly took pictures and put them on the internet.
Something tells me he was stealing his, like, ninth bottle of Wild Irish Rose whiskey. That's the kind of thing you do after eight of those. A fellow that we featured on this show way back, Allison, you were, like, on the absolute vanguard of this guy.
Front edge.
Yeah, he's hit the big time. You guys remember this?
Chocolate rain. Some stay dry and others feel the pain. Chocolate rain. A baby born will die before the sin.
Oh, a baby born will die before the sin. Think about it, people. We've got babies having babies. Internet phenomenon Tay Zonde is taking Chocolate Rain on tour. He's opening for Girl Talk and Dan Deacon in Minneapolis, and he may be adding other dates.
Unbelievable. believable. He's the William Hung of
OSHA. That's what I was just going to say, totally.
In connection with the $1 billion lawsuit involving media giant Viacom, Google, who's being sued by Viacom, wants to depose Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart. Now, Viacom is suing Google for copyright infringement over videos posted on Google-owned YouTube. Now, Viacom owns Comedy Central, MTV, BET, you get the picture. Now, it says video with its content on YouTube is in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Google says, hey, they remove content when asked, so they're complying with the rules of the DMCA, as those, you know, call it. So Google's plan to interview the two most popular fake news anchors today, is it a smart legal play or just a big old publicity stunt? James Boyle is a professor of law at Duke University and the author of The Shakespeare Chronicles. He specializes in public domain law. We asked him to look into this for us. So James, your opinion, is this a publicity stunt or a smart legal move on Google's part to get the most famous people involved in this case, sex it up, or maybe mock the idea of Viacom's position?
Well, it's hard to tell. Google has some very smart lawyers, so I'm fairly sure that what they're doing has some good reasons behind it. I think there might be a couple of good legal reasons why they want to actually have Mr. Colbert and Mr. Stewart up there, other than just the maybe that they would love to meet them in person. One is that Mr. Colbert and Mr. Stewart, their shows completely depend on fair use, the right to use copyrighted material without permission. All of those clips from Fox News and CNN, all the mocking of Larry King and Wolf Blitzer, that's all enabled by a limitation in copyright law called fair use. And Viacom makes a lot of money out of that hole, out of that limitation in copyright law, because Mr. Stewart and Mr. Colbert's shows are so popular.
Oh, I've been a victim of that on Mr. Stewart's show, I have to tell you.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're trying, maybe this is presenting implicitly the statement that says, you know, Viacom, you profit very handsomely from this limitation in copyright law. We, Google, claim that YouTube is covered by a different limitation in copyright law, this exception that's in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that you so accurately named, called the Safe Harbor, that says we're allowed to have stuff uploaded by users so long as we take it down as soon as it's identified. Since you profit from your limitation in copyright law, how about being a little less sanctimonious about us profiting from ours?
Do you think we'd ever be able to read these depositions? Would they ever be public record? Because I bet they might be kind of entertaining.
I think they would be hilarious, and I would hope that they would be available. I think that would be the subject of much legal snarling among the lawyers involved.
Before I let you go, I want to know, do you think that Viacom's suit is a good idea? Do they need to cover themselves and protect their intellectual property, even if it means giving up good viral marketing?
Well, copyright law gives you the right to make dumb business decisions. So even if it were a bad decision, they'd still be fully within their rights. I think right now what we're doing is arguing about the size of the pie that each of these media giants gets out of the display of the videos on YouTube. That's what's at stake here, how much of the share of the revenue. The dangerous thing is that this is also going to make precedent, if it goes to trial, that might affect a lot of other user-generated content. So I just hope that this case doesn't end up making some bad law that restricts the availability of these safe harbors more generally.
We'll keep our eye on it. James Boyle from Duke University, thanks for being with us.
Very nice to talk to you.
Well, speaking of things going down in the courtroom, the two biggest stories in sports this morning really don't have anything to do with players actually playing, which is what they do. I think that's why they call them players. It's all happening in the sort of legal realm. The first biggie is yesterday. This guy, Tim Donaghy, he pled guilty to two felonies related to gambling on games he officiated while he was an NBA ref, one of which I would like to say was a Seattle Supersonics game, which explains a lot about why my beloved team sucked so much last year. Bad reffing. Also, Michael Vick is in a big conference the last couple days with his lawyers trying to figure out if he should strike a plea deal on the dogfighting charges that he's facing. Joining us now to fill us in on this stuff is John DiCepolo. He's a morning sports reporter for CBS TV here in New York. Hi, John.
Luke and Allison, how are you guys doing?
Great. Thanks for coming on the BBP? BPP?
BPP.
What's the show called, Allison?
Brian Park Project.
Thanks for coming on the BPP. Okay, let's start with Tim Donaghy. He's that former NBA ref. He pleaded guilty yesterday. Did anything new emerge when he did that?
Not really. I mean, we knew he was going to be turning himself in for about 3 weeks now, and this was a foregone conclusion. He had already resigned, so obviously his tenure, thank goodness, in the NBA is over. The question is, what's going to be the fallout from this? What's going to be the aftermath of this? And where does David Stern as commissioner need to go to make sure this doesn't happen again? His biggest fear right now is having this thing snowball and mushroom and get out of control. So if he can nip this in the bud, so to speak, and kind of put this to bed as soon as he can and make absolutely certain to the best of his knowledge that something like this does not ever happen again and never get this big, it'll be good for the NBA, because right now it's really a big black eye for the NBA.
Yeah, I guess he has to be happy that in this indictment and other things, there were no other refs that were implicated. So legally, it seems like it's kind of confined to Tim Donaghy. That's got to be good news.
Yeah, it is. And the other thing I think that he was worried about there, Luke, was the fact that, you know, he was worried about it being an official. I think his biggest fear was what would happen if it came out that it was not just an official, but also a player, a prominent athlete, an owner, a coach. I mean, the last thing he wants to see this thing is snowball and get out of control, where he says, oh, my God, I've got to fire half the league.
Right.
We have to start all over again.
I don't know. Some of the child support some of those players are paying. I don't know. Easy touch. Sean Kemp, 35 children. Anyway, okay, but staying in the NBA for a minute, the refs there are definitely sort of the most maligned of any officials. I think it's because NBA refs have to make so many judgment calls that the game
right.
can turn on, you know, and there's all this – they let people travel too much, it seems, and superstars like LeBron James seem to get lots of kind of phantom foul calls.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it doesn't – this doesn't actually involve any other refs, is this has to be bad news for being a ref next year in the NBA, right?
Oh, I just think right now that the microscope is going to be on these guys so much. And what we found out in talking with some players, and it was pretty funny because when this thing first came down, there was a gag order, I guarantee you, put out by the NBA, do not talk about this, do not make comment about this. Some players read their memos. Other players, let's just say, didn't read the fine print. And they decided, you know what, I'm going to speak my mind. Because we talked with several of them. From the Knicks, the Nets, and around the league. And what they said was, if you look at the officiating over the last couple of years, how bad it has been, especially in the playoffs, and it wasn't so much that fouls were called, it was fouls that weren't called. And that was the problem. You know, late in the game, if you have a tie game, let's say it's, you know, 102, 102 all, and LeBron has the ball like he had in game two,
mm-hmm.
and he's driving to the hoop, I guarantee you they're not going to call a foul unless it is so blatant and you absolutely hear a slap on the wrist, on the hand, on the arm, on the head, above the deafening crowd noise.
So if someone starts playing hambone, basically, on a guy, then we
exactly.
may get a call.
Then he may call it. But other than that, I think the biggest thing they have to watch out for is the non-calls. And as you mentioned, you brought up a really good point. You know, these guys are always getting the short end of the stick, and now it's going to be even more so, because all it's going to take now is one game next year, I guarantee it, early in the season, where it's a game-winning shot, and the guy misses it, and he was clearly fouled, and they don't call it. What's the first thing people are going to think of? It's the same. It's going to be the same type of analogy when people think of Barry Bonds.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to me, Barry Bonds, to me, in my personal opinion, is the poster child for steroids. He is always going to be the poster child for steroids, regardless of how many home runs he hits, regardless if they find him guilty or not. I mean, he pretty much admitted, you know, I took steroids, but I didn't know what I was taking. So that's how he danced around the issue.
Well, speaking of athletes who are none too loved right now, Mike Vick.
Oh,
he's, you know, they got the dogfighting charges. It sounds like his alleged cohorts are all pleading guilty, and they're all ready to testify against him if need be. That cannot be good news.
I'll go on record right now, Luke. He's going to jail. I will absolutely predict he'll go to jail, and he's going to go to jail for at least a year.
Wow. That guy's got five lawyers.
Right.
He's got a spokesperson for his five lawyers.
His lawyers have lawyers.
His lawyers have lawyers.
Exactly. When your lawyer has a wardrobe consultant, serious issues going on in your life. I think what they'd like to do is obviously they want to crack down on this, but you've got to wonder how high up this dogfighting thing goes, because I think if the feds could, they would toss the small fish back, meaning Michael Vick, to get to the bigger problem above. But if Michael doesn't speak up and wants to protect his group, his pals, whatever, he's going to jail. There's no question about it. And I think the NBA for the longest time, not that Paul Tagliabue did not do a good job of this, but he wasn't nearly as strict as Roger Goodell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think the NFL needed a new face, because it's very clear from us in the media that Roger Goodell does not take any crap from anyone.
Well, that's,
I don't care who you are.
It's interesting because we're talking about you know, you mentioned Barry Bonds, and it seems like in Major League Baseball, Bud Selig, the commissioner, has looked kind of a little bit wimpy. He's sort of there kind of clapping for Bonds.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, over this guy, Roger Goodell, who runs the NFL, he's kind of a tough guy. I was reading this morning that, you know, there's a NFL policy that bans gambling of any kind. And, like, Vic could be kicked out of the league. He could be banned for life just for betting on dogfights if that's proven. I mean, so could you see Goodell doing something that extreme?
Yes, I absolutely could. He'll make an example. The same reason why he's holding Pac-Man Jones out a year. He said, this has got to stop. Do you know that in over 1,500 players that play in the NFL, do you realize that over half, Luke, have criminal records? I'm not talking about breaking and entering. I'm talking about assault, rape, attempted murder. This is a serious problem the NFL has.
It's almost like if you pump a guy up on possibly steroids, have him work out 20 hours a day and reward all of his aggression.
And pay him to be aggressive.
It's almost like that's bad for a guy.
Exactly. Allison, you make a very good point. That's exactly what it is. They're paying these guys to be aggressive. And here's the problem. You want them to be animals on Sunday, and you want them to be gentlemen 6 days a week. It doesn't work that way. You can't just flip a switch and turn it off. These guys are always going to be hyped up and gung-ho. Now, having said that, am I labeling all NFL players like that? Absolutely not. There are certainly some great players out there that conduct themselves like professionals, and they always have and they always will. But when you get the bad apples, I mean, some of these guys are really, really bad, and they're rotten to the core. And this just hasn't just happened now. There's a track record of this going back to college, going back to high school. The NFL knows about it, but they don't care. They want to put butts in the seats. It comes down to the same thing, which it's always come down to, which is money, the almighty dollar, because the owners are making a killing on this game.
John DiCepolo, morning sports reporter for CBS TV in New York. Thanks, John.
All right, Luke. Thanks, Allison.
We're about halfway through this edition of the Bryant Park Project. Want to get you caught up to date on some of the news headlines from today. There have been powerful aftershocks in Peru today. This after a 7.9 magnitude quake struck along the Pacific coast. At least at this point, 337 people are dead. At least 1,300 are injured. Hospitals are obviously overwhelmed. Dead bodies have been gathering on the streets in the town of Pisco.
A new report says suicides in the U.S. Army are at their highest level since the time of the first Gulf War. The Army recorded 17.3 suicides per 10,000 soldiers in 2006. A third of them occurred in war zones. The Army said failed relationships, legal and financial issues, and occupational operational issues led to the suicides.
The Food and Drug Administration says it will examine whether over-the-counter cold medicines are safe for very young children to consume. Doctors in Baltimore noticed that some 900 kids under the age of 5 suffered symptoms of an overdose in 1 year period.
And as we just heard, former NBA ref Tim Donaghy pleaded guilty to felony charges for taking cash payoffs from gamblers and betting on games, even some that he officiated. Donaghy could be sentenced to 25 years in prison. He was released on a $250,000 bond. Where'd he get the $250,000 for the bond? I like this music. It makes me feel, like, tough.
Does this music make you feel like maybe somebody's playing games with your life?
I always feel that way.
You can't explain what's happening, why it's happening. Maybe it's all just some kind of crazy dream. Maybe you're just a player in someone else's dream. Well, there's a philosopher who is suggesting that the higher power making and creating the ways of the world might actually be someone, you know, playing a Sims video game. And guess what? You and I are just the characters he's created in a real-life matrix.
So the idea is that what we're seeing, this life that I experienced this morning,
yes.
I got up, I got on the subway, I came here. I'm just I'm a character in a video game, or I'm a person in a movie or something.
And there's somebody out there doing all of this.
I'm getting a nosebleed thinking about it.
You sit down, wipe your little nose. We'll talk to Nick Bostrom, the director of Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute, the philosopher we've been talking about. So, Nick, what made you pursue this theory that somewhere, someone is out there creating our world through some sort of technology?
Well, what you're really referring to, I think, is the simulation argument. And that argument tries to show that one of three possibilities is true. One of those three possibilities is this simulation hypothesis that you were alluding to, the hypothesis that we are living in a computer simulation built by some technologically highly advanced civilization. But the argument itself doesn't show that that's the possibility that obtains. There are also two other possibilities.
That's a relief.
No, that is kind of a good thing to know. Some of the things that you wrote about this possibility, which is really fascinating, is that we don't have the technology to do something like this now, or so we think we don't have it. What makes you confident, or what makes you believe that we would be able to create that kind of technology for the future?
Well, we can study possible computational systems and their performance, even though we can't build them yet. So with advanced molecular nanotechnology and other advanced technologies, we can see what kinds of computers are physically possible and the kind of computing power those systems would have. We can also estimate the computational power of the human brain, and therefore how much computing power it would take to simulate one brain, or indeed simulate all human brains that have ever lived. And it turns out that even using fairly conservative assumptions, an advanced, a technologically mature civilization would be able to simulate all human brains that have ever lived, even just using a tiny fraction of its computational power for that purpose. And so the conclusion then is that if there are any such civilizations around that are at all interested in creating these ancestor simulations, then they could create many, many more simulations of this sort, so that almost all people who have ever lived would be computer-simulated people rather than people living in the original history.
Now, this New York Times article that was written about your work has this quote that everybody has sort of jumped on, and I want to get your take on it. The quote is that you have a gut feeling there's a 20% chance that we're living in a matrix. Why does your gut say 20%, and how would we ever know that we were living in such a matrix?
Well, the simulation argument, which I do think is correct, shows that one of three possibilities is true. The first one being that almost all civilizations at our stage of technological development become extinct before reaching technological maturity.
All right, so one group of people's gone.
Sorry?
One group of people gone. What's the next
possibility? Well, the next possibility is that almost all technologically mature civilizations throughout the universe, wherever there are planets with such civilizations on them, all of them lose interest in creating these ancestor simulations. Maybe they have better things to do with all their computing power.
All right, so they get bored and they don't do it.
Yeah.
And the third one is
that we are in a computer simulation, literally, one built by some technologically hyper-advanced civilization somewhere. And so that's what the simulation argument shows. One of those three, you can't coherently reject all three of them. Now, then it's anybody's guess which one of those three is the true one. My view is that we don't have any strong evidence to pick one particular of these three possibilities. So instead, we should assign some probability to each one of them, reflecting our ignorance. And 20%, you know, you could argue that it should be 10% or 30% probability. I personally think that maybe the second possibility is slightly more likely.
everybody just got bored with it all. Nick Bostrom, the director of Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute. Thanks for blowing our mind today.
Good to be with you.
You know, if this is like a Worlds of Warcraft or something, I want to be an awesome like warrior Viking dwarf with a battle axe. Can I be that?
Maybe the guy just heard you. Anything's possible.
All right, coming up, my conversation with Junior Senior, a band that you're going to want to hear, and also a discussion of Hillary Clinton's secret weapon, Huma.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. By the way, if you don't know about Rod Stewart's first band, Faces, that's who this is right now, you got to check them out. This is such a great song. Coming up, we're going to, speaking of bands, talk to Junior Senior. They're a Danish band that we're very excited about. They got a new record out. First, though, as you know, you can't really pick up a newspaper or turn on CNN without seeing, you know, some story about one of the 47,000 people running for president. I think that's actually the actual number 47,000 people have declared. Yeah. Minus one because Tommy Thompson's out. But anyway, a story, though, that is not getting a lot of play when they talk about this is Hillary Clinton's super secret weapon, which is Huma.
Huma?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that a vitamin? Is that an herb?
It's more. It's all that and more, Allison. I first heard about Project Huma from NPR producer Kadia Dunn, who joins us now on the phone. Hi, Kadia. So, okay, take us back a couple months. You and I were talking about this experience you had. You were at a party, and a friend of yours was going on and on about this woman who's an aide to Hillary Clinton, right?
Right, right. On and on. He was, you know, he was totally enamored of her, and I sort of dismissed it as, you know, he just had a crush on some girl.
What was he saying about her?
You know, she's just so beautiful, and she's sort of traffic-stopping beautiful. And also, he had been in an event with her, this political event, and it was apparently very hot there, and everyone was just sweating buckets, and she did not sweat a drop, according to him. She was wearing, like, some kind of wool gabardine suit.
I love that in Washington that earns you higher right. status, that you don't sweat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is she magic? She wasn't sweating.
Well, he was describing her like she was magic. And, again, I was like, yeah, whatever, on and on.
So
and
then you end up, though, at this fancy restaurant doing a story for NPR, and who walks in but Hillary Clinton?
Right. So it's actually not a fancy restaurant. It's a little cafe that we were at. Senator Clinton walks in, and, you know, this whole restaurant turns their attention to her, and all of a sudden, you know, it's the mob, as we call it, the gangbang, where everyone tries to rush in and get their microphone in her face. So that's my primary objective at the moment, is getting tape from her. And yeah. And then I feel this tug on my arm, and I turn around, and there's Huma trying to get me actually to stop taping Senator Clinton. But I was completely arrested. It was dear.
By the police? Or?
No. She was truly, as my friend had described her, she was totally beautiful and so calm and collected in the middle of this, you know, mob scene that we were having.
And what was the effect on you? What did she say to you?
She, you know, I can't even remember what she said. Who knows what it was? It was some sort of magical language that she speaks. But
Humese.
It had the exact effect that she wanted, which was that I completely forgot what I was doing, which was my job, and just stood there thinking about her, and it was like a flash to back to the party, and I thought, oh, my God, he was totally right.
Wow. And then you got obsessed with Huma and tried to find out a bunch of stuff about
right.
her.
So then I immediately called my friend and said, you're so right. She's some sort of other non-human being. And we started madly Googling her and trying to find any information we could about her, which we couldn't find any. But then sort of a friend of a friend talked to this reporter into writing a story about her, and it was totally satisfying. We got all the good dirt.
Well, speaking of which, Allison.
This is where I take over. In fact, a bunch of different publications were equally as enamored with Huma. They
Huma, excuse me. Respect.
See, I've
the
done
name.
That. A couple. I've called her Huma a couple because of Uma Thurman. Anyway, Huma Abedin. She was featured in a Vogue photo shoot recently, and in last week's Village Voice, Michael Musto dished on this very fancy lady. He joins us now. Now, first of all, Michael, you're a tough nut to crack. You have seen it all. Are you
under
the Huma spell as well?
I like her because she's one of the rare people who's very savvy about Middle Eastern relations and also loves a good Marc Jacobs bag. You know, she's got it all. And she seems to be totally unflappable. I can understand this kind of fascination with her because until recently she seemed to be a total mystery. Now we're finding out more about her because she's in Vogue. She's kind of a Muslim Salma Hayek from Kalamazoo, Michigan, okay? When she was 2 years old, she moved to Saudi Arabia, and her parents, her father has passed on, but he was a scholar. Her mother's a professor. And she's kind of an interesting amalgam. And she's been described as Hillary's body person, whatever that means. She's 32 and single. You do the math.
Oh.
No, I'm joking. But she's also the star of the new movie 310 to Huma. Oh, no, that's Russell Crowe. I don't know. I the more you know about her, the less you know, actually.
One of the things I think is the Clintons are very, very media savvy, very smart people. So why are they pushing this beautiful 32-year-old Muslim woman who is fluent in Arabic, swathed in cashmere.
May have dated John Cusack.
Allegedly.
Well, right.
Why is she going to the forefront? What's the deal?
I always think, you know, I'll call me cynical, Allison, but I always think this is a preemptive strike. They're putting her out in the press so that no Republican can later say, who is this beautiful woman who's been described as Hillary's body person? You know, but one thing I like about the fact that Hillary hired her in the first place is this is the kind of person Bush would have strip searched at an airport. You know, this is a...
Maybe me too. Have you seen El Hajj?
Huma, yeah.
Yeah.
She's a Middle Eastern person who, you know, Hillary is using for her savvy in that very area.
But I heard she's also like an expert packer. Like she has these amazing skills that are very actually helpful to the campaign. So beyond just being, you know, beautiful and everything, that she's super effective. Like someone said, if Hillary has even gets a chill, suddenly Huma just appears with like a shawl that she wove out of, you know, rainbows.
Yes. I mean, she has magical skills, literally. She has a great fashion sense. But also, she's the person who watches over Hillary on the road. That's what a body person is. She's her aide-de-camp. And her job is to make sure Hillary doesn't screw up, or if she does screw up, that there's nobody else around to see it. And she's apparently very good at doing that. And if Hillary goes all the way, Huma is going to be rewarded with, you know, an even better job.
All right. Well, Michael Musta, we're going to count on you to keep your eye on Huma and all the Huma activities. We'll be checking back with you, and we thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you.
And thanks, Kadia, if you're still there. Adios. Let's jump over to Matt Martinez, who's also wearing wool gabardine today and not sweating. He's got the news.
Thanks, guys. Disaster in Peru. After a 7.9 magnitude quake shook that country's Pacific coast, at least 337 people are dead, around 1,300 injured. NASA is still up in the air, or space, where there is no air, whatever, over whether astronauts need to repair a deep gouge in on Endeavour's belly. They say they're cautiously optimistic they can just leave it alone. NBA ref Tim Donaghy pleaded guilty to cash payoffs and betting on games he officiated. He faces up to 25 years in prison. And noise in the mine. A camera and microphone picked up some sound in the Utah mine where six miners have been trapped for 10 days. Those are some of the headlines making news this morning. You can find the news online all the time at NPR.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
I cannot get to no, you better, baby.
These are the dance-tastic sounds of Junior Senior off their new record. It's called Hey Hey My My Yo Yo. This is a song called Can I Get. And I'm just going to put a challenge out to the listeners. I dare you not to get your groove on right now. I dare you. Junior Senior is actually two guys from Denmark. Jeppe Larsen, goes by Senior. He's a kind of like a chubby gay guy. And then you've got Jesper Mortensen. He's Junior. He's a really skinny little straight guy. Their record just came out in the U.S. this week, and we talked to them yesterday when they swung by our L.A. studios. I have been counting the days for the release of your new record, and then I looked somewhere and I saw that it was out in Japan 2 years ago. What was the holdup?
The big holdup to get you excited is like a build-up.
Yeah, but there's a point at which
two-year build-up.
It's too much, right? Two years was too much.
No, we were going for the build-up.
we decided after the first album that, you know, we got a lot of experience from being on different labels to sort of, you can figure out when they really like you, and then you see how much that, you know, has to do with success or like, you know, how it comes out in different countries. So I think we're just based on our experience with some bad experience certain places that we wanted to find a label in the US that was really, you know, generally excited about it and wasn't just saying like, oh, we love you, and then, you know.
Right. Well, you guys, though, I mean, while you were waiting to find a label here in the U.S. that you liked, a couple years elapsed, and a couple summers ago you had this giant hit. It was called Move Your Feet, which everybody was listening to. Here, let's hear some of that. That was Move Your Feet off of your guys' last record. And first of all, Jesper, I thought for all the world that was Michael Jackson singing, but actually that was you. And that was like a giant, giant hit. Was that the number one song in Denmark that summer?
No, it was actually never... I don't even remember if it was released as... Yeah, I think it was released as a single, but it didn't really do that well in Denmark.
What? I got to stop getting all my research from Wikipedia.
No, but it was the second most played song in Denmark that year. Denmark is a small place, so I think you have to sell like 700 copies 1 week to be number one in the singles chart. So, I mean, it's not really that impressive.
What did you guys listen to as kids in Denmark? I mean, it sounds like a lot of Michael Jackson, a lot of, you know, kind of danceable stuff. What were you guys into?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Denmark, of course, you listen to a lot of Danish music. And, I mean, I think when we kind of, all the stuff that we are really into now, we mainly discovered when we were kind of in our teens, I guess, when you find your own music taste. But a lot of the stuff we like, we were never really exposed to as children, like a lot of black music, old black music, like the 60s Motown stuff and all the Stax and James Brown, for example, and also like the B-52s. I think what we knew of like the B-52s or the Talking Heads kind of thing, we only knew like a few hit songs. But we didn't really know their albums because, I mean, our parents don't really listen to that. I mean, they got some Beatles records, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the most, like, really popular stuff. But all the kind of more, like, I don't know, lesser-known bands. I mean, in America, I think, you know, everybody kind of knows, you know, Talking Heads, they know Devo or David Bowie, but
yeah, or you hear a lot of James Brown on radio.
You just hear it on the radio all the time, and your parents play it at parties. But it's not really like that in Denmark, so you kind of have to go out and kind of make up your own taste and your own mind about music.
Were you guys sort of the odd teenagers who were getting into this 1960s, you know, black music from America?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we were definitely listening to a whole different, you know, music than everybody else was, like. In the early 90s, I guess, the dance, Euro dance thing was really big in Denmark. And if you were into, you know, like real music, you were into kind of, you know, the grunge thing. I mean, but we were also listening to a lot of guitar bands, of course. I guess that's kind of where we started, you know, like Sonic Youth or like the English ones, like, I don't know, Ride or My Bloody Valentine or Blur later. We were really into them and Pulp and that kind of thing. You know, and then it kind of developed into, you know, listening, finding out, like, you know, who did the, like, Blur like, or who did Sonic Youth like, and stuff like that, you know, kind of going back from there.
Well, you also released this EP called Say Hello, Wave Goodbye, which I guess you get in the same box when you buy your latest CD, which is Hey Hey My My Yo Yo. And on this EP, I noticed that it's a lot more sort of guitar stuff. It kind of sounds like Duran Duran, a little bit of maybe like New Order. It's very kind of 80s pop. But there's a song on there that the title kind of sticks out. The title is I Can't Rap, I Can't Sing, But I Would Do Anything for Love. And I wondered, I mean, Denmark is not really known for its rapping, but Jeppe, you do a lot of kind of what you could call really basic rapping on a lot of the songs. Is that, do you think you're a good rapper?
It's so funny because it's, you know, for us it's just the play of words. It's really got nothing to do in the sense of rap as a culture, as a you know, it's I mean, especially in the US, I think it's very, you know, when that's sort of taking a stand if you say like, oh, I'm a rapper or I rap, you know.
We just like, you know, the rhythm, and we like, you know, hip-hop, and we like rap and all that stuff. So we just try to incorporate it in our music in kind of our way.
Give me a beat that I can dance.
Give me a street where I can.
Give me a beat that I can dance to.
Give me a rhyme so I can.
Give me the time so I can.
Give me a rhyme so I can boogaloo. And give me a boy so I can give me a girl that I can give me a boy so we can have fun. And give me a choice so I can make
give me a voice so I can
give me a choice so I can make one.
So much of your music is so incredibly, you know, happy and upbeat. It's some of my favorite stuff to listen to when I'm, you know, getting ready to go out. Got a cocktail in one hand, junior, senior on the record player. But what do you guys do when you're kind of down? Like, do you ever want to write, like, a Stairway to Heaven kind of song?
I mean, I really, really like that song, of course. It's a classic, but, you know, we do stuff that has kind of a mellow thing to it sometimes. But I just think when we do our music, it's just very natural for us to kind of try to, you know, shout really loud and, you know, sing as loud as we can and as, I wouldn't say crazy, but kind of as wild as we can. I mean, that's, we're not really like quiet singers, like, you know, and we just, yeah, it just gets wild. And
yeah, I wouldn't record Hey Nina as a single. I don't think it has legs as a single. But
you know, I think there's a lot of layers in our music, and I'm not asking, you know, for people to, that they have to find that, but if you listen, you know, it's definitely there.
Yeah, I think actually you got a really good point. I mean, all good music just kind of brings some kind of emotion, you know, you get some kind of feeling or vibe out of it. And I feel the same about Led Zeppelin. That makes me wanna dance sometimes. Sometimes, like, you know, just take your fist into the air and like, yeah.
Well, we have a segment on the show, actually, that we mostly do on our website. It's called Best Song in the World Today, where we just put something. In fact, we had your song up there, Can I Get. We had that up the other day. Do you guys have a recommendation? Nice. Not off of your record, but something else you're listening to? What's the best song in the world today, according to Junior Senior?
That's so hard. Yesterday I listened to, I think it's called I'm 18 by Alice Cooper. I really like that one.
All right, 18 by Alice Cooper. That's from, yeah, from Junior. And Senior, what are you listening to?
I'm blank.
What's on your iPod? Okay. If I went and turned on your iPod right now?
I don't know.
You don't have an iPod. Thank God you're not a DJ. You don't, like, spin for people for a living. By choosing songs.
There'll be like big holes in the music and be like, I don't know what
should
to
I play.
yeah, it's good, but you're working on it. I appreciate it. Well, listen, you guys, thank you so much for coming in. And Jesper, I know you've got kind of a bad voice and you got to play a show tonight, so thanks for coming in and talking. And and
no
Yeppe
problem.
Thanks for illuminating us on the music you like. It's been really helpful. That was Yeppe Larsen and Jesper Mortensen. They are Junior and Senior of the Danish dance band Junior Senior. They got a new record out. It's called Hey Hey My My Yo Yo. You should probably go get it.
I kept waiting for him to say that now is the time we're down to the Sprockets. The whole interview. It was great, Luke.
Thanks, Allie.
I'm very into the groove of it all. And thank you for listening to the Bryant Park Project. The show is directed by Mr. Dan Pashman. Our producers are MJ Davis, Wynn Rosenfeld, Lauren Spohr, Lospo. Manoli Weatherall is at the big soundboard. Matt Martinez, not only newsreader, but senior producer.
McShane!
I'm Allison Stewart.